You would think the sight of hungry wildlife huddled together in the freezing cold of a blizzard would stir those who love wildlife to want to feed them. But that is not so for the elk of Jackson Hole. This leads us to ask, should government stop winter feeding wildlife?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with your host, Michael Olson. And now get ready for 1 hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 1,259th edition of the Food Chain Radio program. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends down there in Cairns who are tuned into the Food Chain podcast at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio. Folks, the sight of hungry wildlife weathering a freezing blizzard is enough to stir the emotions of every wildlife enthusiast. And yet, there are some wildlife enthusiasts who want the government to stop feeding those, winter feeding those wildlife. Case in point, the winter feeding of the southern Greater Yellowstone Ecosystem elk herd at Jackson Hole, Wyoming. Rather than allowing the 11,000 elk of the immediate area to fend for themselves in the wilds of the Teton Mountains, the elk are encouraged to come down to a U.S. Fish and Wildlife Refuge bordering on the tourist town of Jackson. There, the elk are fed a mixture of hay and alfalfa pellets through the coldest months of the winter. This feeding at the trough greatly concentrates the elk population. National Elk Refuge senior biologist Eric Cole said, "During feeding operations, which is when they're actually feeding the elk, we commonly have elk in densities of 1,000 elk per square kilometer." That's a kilometer, not a mile. The problem with this animal feeding charity is that the concentration it engenders exacerbates the spread of disease. And for the first time, another disease has appeared among the Jackson elk herd that is 100% lethal, chronic wasting disease. We came to know these encephalopathy afflictions when they spread among cattle. We called it mad cow disease. Biologist Cole said, "Feeding by itself is definitely the strongest predictor of elk contact rates." Wildlife disease specialist Chris Colgan said, "I think to do the feeding on elk feed grounds has a potential for disaster. Our economy and our identity in western Wyoming is associated with elk populations. Just to do nothing in the light of this discovery should not be an option." And so, a coalition of wildlife-loving groups has taken action by filing a lawsuit against government wildlife agencies to stop feeding the hungry animals. And that leads us to ask, should government stop winter feeding wildlife? Who better to ask than Kristen Combs, Executive Director of Wyoming Wildlife Advocates. Kristen, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks for having me. I'm happy to be here.
Well, good. Where's here?
Here for me is in Jackson, Wyoming. Everyone's familiar with Jackson Hole, I'm sure. And it's a beautiful place. The Tetons are a wonderful place to live and visit, but also have some intense wildlife issues that are definitely something that is always in the forefront of a lot of people's minds that live here.
You know, I think there's two places that have been in every television commercial on Earth. One of them is the Bixby Bridge in the Big Sur of California coast, and the other is Jackson Hole and the Teton Mountains.
I would agree with you. I see pictures of the Tetons all over the place all the time. So they are photogenic, and you know, a lot of people see the famous Molten Barn in front of the beautiful Teton Range, and it is a spectacularly beautiful place.
And you're a Midwest girl, so do you enjoy living in amidst the mountains like that?
I do. I feel like, coming from flatland area to the mountains, I feel like, I don't know, the mountains just feed my soul, and I really needed to be somewhere where I could be close to wildlife, and there's no better place in the lower 48 to be amongst wildlife and to be able to, you know, kind of walk outside your back door and and see wildlife on a daily basis.
Right. And do you remember that moment in your life, Kristen, when the apple fell on your head and you decided that you were going to become an advocate for wildlife?
You know, I think it was more of a slower transition for me. I mean, I've always known that I want to fight to protect in the environment and nature, and I've always felt a strong connection to nature. And I think for me, it was more of a path of education. And I was a school teacher for a while and really enjoyed, you know, sharing different things with school children. And I even taught adults for a while. And, you know, a lot of things that, you know, there's just a lot of stuff out there that people don't know or that they might not realize. And so I saw that education was a real path to helping to protect these areas because, you know, what people love and tend to know the best is something that they want to protect. And so it was kind of more of a roundabout way for me. But then, you know, when I realized that I really do care about these issues and that, you know, there's certainly a plethora of organizations out there that are taking them on. Some of these other issues like chronic wasting disease and trophy hunting of wolves and things like that were kind of more pressing and seemed pretty dire. And so I think at that point in time, I really wanted to get involved and to do more.
Well, as a teacher, teach us what you see when you see the elk being winter fed there at Jackson Hole.
Yeah, so, you know, the elk feeding started as a way to help protect the Jackson Hole elk herd. And when it was, when the National Elk Refuge was instituted, there were a lot of ranches and homesteads that were on their their historical wintering grounds. And so there was a lot of conflicts that were occurring between ranchers and elk at the time. And elk were starving. It was a harsh winter in the winter of 1911 and 1912, was when the elk refuge was instituted. And people here in West Wyoming care about elk. I mean, they're a very prolific species, and they're something that, you know, a lot of people rely upon for a food source. There's wildlife guides and watching tours, and there's hunting outfitters. So they're a big part of our economy, and they're a big part of our culture here as well. And when they are congregated in these areas, so what started as kind of a good idea about, you know, let's feed these animals and try and help them survive through the winter, has become not so great. And we know that concentrating animals in high densities is bad for them. And
before we go on, tell us what you see. Give us a vision of what you see when you see those elk being fed. What does it look like for those of us who haven't seen it?
That's a good point. If you come to the elk refuge in the summertime, you won't see any elk. They are only there in the winter because that is where they come down. It's in a low point in the valley. And so the National Elk Refuge, it sits right north of town, and it's a pretty wide open space with some buttes, and then kind of leads into the Gros Ventre Mountains. And the elk all make their way there, usually in late October and in through November and December. And then once we're deep into the winter, like we are now, there are thousands of elk. So anywhere between 4,500 and 8,500 or 9,000 elk will winter on the National Elk Refuge. So you're seeing large groups of elk, and it's fascinating to see. There are sleigh rides that you can take that will take you out to see the elk. You can get really close to them. There's the big bulls with their antlers still on. Usually they don't drop their antlers until later on in the winter, so that's a fun thing to see. And, you know, a big part of our tourist economy is relying upon that. When I'm looking at that, I really see what is an unhealthy and unnatural situation. If you go up to Yellowstone, for example, where elk are not fed, you'll see elk spread along, you know, out on the landscape. Now, they do still come down into the valleys in the winter where the snow levels are a little lower and, you know, temperatures are a little bit warmer. But they are usually scattered out onto south-facing slopes that, you know, don't have as much snow on them or might be windswept.
They're foraging, right?
Yeah, and they're foraging. They paw down through the snow. They're very adaptable. You know, these animals have evolved here in the Rocky Mountains, and so they're used to finding food and know where to go in the wintertime to find food. And so in a natural situation, you have elk that are herded up, but not herded so closely that they are in direct contact with each other. And the males actually tend to stay pretty much away from the females. The only time of year that they're really together is during the rut. But on the National Elk Refuge and on these feed grounds, you'll actually see, you know, males and females close together.
Does it look like a feedlot, like a confined animal feeding operation at the time? Like I read a piece where 1,000 elk in 1 square kilometer.
There's a lot of elk, yes.
That's and a lot of...
The hoppers that come out, they feed them sort of a dense alfalfa pellet. And those hoppers that come out kind of make lines. And so you'll actually see the elk in kind of a uniform line just right next to each other, you know, one right after the other feeding on these areas. And then
so it's kind of like a 1,000 elk feeding at the trough.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it's pretty much what you would expect to see on any kind of a livestock operation or, you know, somewhere where there were cattle being raised or something like that. It's a very unnatural situation.
And that's the calling to question here, right? We have a very unnatural situation in a very natural world of wildlife in the greater Yellowstone ecosystem. So there you go. Now, why do we feed the elk? Let's talk a little bit about that. Seems like there's two fundamental reasons.
Sure. One is to obviously increase the survival of elk in the wintertime. So the Jacksonville elk herd is roughly anywhere from 11,000 to 13,000 animals usually in a given year, and which exceeds the carrying capacity of the landscape here in northwest Wyoming. So if you look at survival rates of natural free-ranging elk, mortality rates can approach, you know, 10 to 15% in the wintertime sometimes. That's just a naturally occurring process. In feed ground elk, we have mortality rates that are closer to 1 to 3%. And so you're having...
What was the difference again? The natural rate is what?
The natural rate can be anywhere from like 10 to 15%, and even get close to 20% in, you know, harder years.
In hard years, yeah.
Yeah, but on the feed grounds, we're looking at more of like a 1 to 2% mortality rate. Now, there are diseases that are already present on the feed grounds, and those obviously increase mortality somewhat. So the increase of mortality is something that wildlife managers are trying to keep low, and then to also keep, you know, these herds really large, kind of unnaturally large. There is a large the hunting outfitting business here is really big in northwest Wyoming, and there are certain outfitters that like to have a plethora of elk and can guarantee that elk kill for their clients. And so having this unnaturally large elk herd is beneficial to them financially.
Well, on that note, let's take a quick break. And when we come back, we'll finish up why we feed elk in the winter. Because there's a big money in there. Stay tuned, right back.
History buffs, this tale from Michael Olson's Tales from a Tin Can took place while the USS Dale steamed through the Bering Sea, January 1943.
We took some terrible waves up there. One time a big groundswell rolled us over so far I thought we'd never make it back. I was on the lee deck when the ship went over into that roll. Luckily, I was able to grab onto a bulkhead handrail, and when the Dale went over, my feet left the deck. I hung there with nothing between my feet and the ocean but air. I was scared. She went over on her beam, paused for a minute, then she shuddered and shook because one of her propellers was out of the water and thrashing air. Slowly, very slowly, she rolled back toward the vertical, and my feet found the deck again. That wave scared the devil out of me.
Tales from a Tin Can contains 424 tales by 44 sailors aboard the USS Dale, from Pearl Harbor to Tokyo Bay. Order your Father's Day copy at talesfromatincan.com. That's talesfromatincan.com. Talesfromatincan.com.
now, back to What's Eating What on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, we are back. Folks, we're talking about probably one of the most beautiful places on earth, Jackson Hole, Wyoming, the little tourist town of Jackson, the surrounding Teton Mountains. Oh my goodness, if you've ever been there, you just got to get down on your hands and knees and thank the good Lord that he made such a beautiful place. And he did, and it's filled with wildlife. And so we're trying to come to grips with how we manage that wildlife, and it must be managed. Is that not true, Kristen?
You know, that's a loaded question, for sure. I think it depends on who you ask.
Asking Kristen Combs, who is the executive director of the Wyoming Wildlife Advocates. So you advocate for wildlife, which means you fight for them. In a world where there's a lot of contending interests.
That is very true. And we're always striving to think about what's best for the wildlife and how can we return to more natural systems and have healthy ecosystems. I think a lot of people look at this place and think that it's, you know, a wildlife paradise, and we have a lot of wildlife here, certainly. But if you look a little deeper, you'll see that there are a myriad of issues, and some of our ecosystems are actually not very healthy. So wildlife management comes down to, you know, what numbers do we think are acceptable for species and what numbers do we want to have for those species? And so, for instance, you know, most animals that are prey species, we obviously want a large amount of those or an excess amount of those so that we can hunt them. And we want to, you know, make sure that that's something that people will find success at.
Which also is a way of managing the herds too, right?
Exactly, yeah. So we've kind of, we humans have sort of set up these arbitrary numbers that we want to see species kept at in order to have an excess for hunting. That's not to say that that's what's healthy for the ecosystem. And, you know, other animal species like carnivore species are something that we have been pretty harsh on our management in the past, and we've seen the effects to ecosystems of doing that. So it all depends on, you know, what we want as humans and what we, if we're looking at more species specific management or are we looking at ecosystem management more holistically?
So, and before we took the break, we were talking about those who have an interest in the elk herd would include ranchers of the area whose haystacks can contend for attention with the elk and the cattle. And of course, the ranchers want to use the haystacks to feed the cattle, and the elk want to use the haystacks to feed the elk. So that's one of the interests that is involved in feeding the elk. We want to feed the elk so they stay out of the haystacks. Fair enough?
Exactly. That is one of the other main reasons that feed grounds exist. That's kind of a twofold issue. One is that, like you said, elk will eat natural forage on ranch lands, and they will also eat haystacks. And then also there is a disease called brucellosis, which causes cattle to abort their young. And that is something that is the managers have been fighting for years. And ranchers do not want cattle and intermingling with wild free-ranging elk because they are afraid of that transmission of brucellosis to their herd.
Do you see the brucellosis in the winter-fed elk population there in Jackson and throughout Wyoming?
Yes, there, brucellosis is now endemic in Wyoming, and our elk herds are infected with the disease,
okay,
which is a bacterial disease.
So then the ranchers are going, oh my God, keep those disease critters away from my cattle.
Exactly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. And the other big thing, as we touched on before, is the hunt, because Wyoming is well known throughout the world for a place to go hunting elk. And if you've ever had an elk steak, not a bad thing to do. And so that's a big business in Wyoming, too. So there's an interest.
It definitely is big business. Outfitting industries make exorbitant amounts of money for offering elk hunts. And and even just, you know, in licenses to the state. And Wyoming has had very, very successful elk hunting seasons, and we have one of the highest hunter success rates in the country. close to 50% of a success rate for elk hunters, which is usually, you know, you're only looking at like 20% success rates for hunting. So we do have a high success rate here, and elk hunting is a big tourist draw as well. So yeah, there's a lot of money to be made there and a lot of money to be had. And
that kind of that kind of fills in the tourist season, between the tourist season, the summer tourist season, and the winter skiing season too. You have the hunting season.
Mm-hmm. Right? Exactly.
So there's a big interest in the feeding of the elk. We want more elk. We want every hunter to be successful. So there you go. And that's another incentive to winter feed the elk. Now let's look at the other side of the coin. Why not feed the elk? I mean,
yeah, intuitively,
as a wildlife advocate, you must want to feed the elk. Must you not?
You know, if I think about it, like me personally, yes, I don't want to see any animals starve. I mean, unfortunately, nature is harsh, and there are animals that starve every year naturally. And I certainly don't want that to happen to animals, especially if it's, you know, for human reasons, human cause reasons. However, what we know now scientifically about feeding wildlife is that it is very bad for them. The disease transmission rates go up. These wildlife, especially wildlife like mule deer, for example, have very specialized guts that are not very receptive to the feed that we feed them. There are still people, even though we have a county ordinance here in Jackson against feeding wildlife, there are still people that feed wildlife and don't realize that it's very bad for them, actually. And you'll find mule deer, for example, dead on the side of the road with bellies full of hay because they can't digest it. And so what we know now scientifically about feeding wildlife is that it is just not good for them. And so while I'm sympathetic to the fact that, you know, animals may starve if we are not there feeding them, that's just the natural progression of things and the natural order of how ecosystems work. And then those animals, you know, become food for other scavengers and help to enrich the land that they're on. And to have these diseased areas, which are, you know, just kind of breeding grounds for spreading the disease, is definitely not helpful. And that's not working toward having healthy ecosystems either.
You know, when I was a youngster growing up in Billings, Montana, the folks always took the Olson siblings to Yellowstone Park because it was close and it was fun for kids. And the reason it was so much fun for kids is because it was filled with bears. Everywhere you look, there were bears standing beside the road, begging, running around the campgrounds, rifling garbage cans. And for kids, it was wonderful, you know, to have these bears to play with. But then in the last time I took a trip to Yellowstone with a family, I was, you know, getting on in my teen years, there was a sign on the gate at Yellowstone Park, and it said, "Don't feed the bears." And, you know, I said, "Dad, why not feed the bears? We have food and they're hungry." And so he gave me this wonderful talking to that I still remember today about how if you feed the bears, you make them dependent upon you. Are we not doing that with the elk of Yellowstone?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I think human altruism, we just want to reach a helping hand out to wildlife whenever we can. Like you said, we have resources and we want to share those with our wild neighbors. But yes, we need to, while on the surface it looks like, oh, this might be a good thing, this animal's going to get a meal today, there are so many more problems and complications involved with it that we don't see. And that now that, you know, we have the scientific information and knowledge about, we can do a better job to make these animals be in a more natural state and stop feeding them, because we know it's bad for them at this point.
And we do have some good science as to what's going on the elk feeding grounds of Wyoming. Now, we understand that there's, what, 23 different feeding grounds being employed throughout Wyoming to feed the elk?
Yes, there's 22 that are run by the state, and then there's the National Elk Refuge, which is run by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service.
Okay. And these are the good folks that you are suing, correct?
We have a suit right now against the U.S. Forest Service because some of the feed grounds that are owned and run by the state are actually located on Forest Service land. And the main issue that we are having is that the Forest Service hasn't done a proper analysis of the environmental impacts and the impacts to wildlife that these feed grounds have. They are just issuing permits to the state of Wyoming to operate them without doing a proper analysis of what the real environmental impacts are there. So any federal agency that takes on an action is responsible for making sure that whatever that action is, it doesn't have significant impacts to the environment.
So you're telling them you're not paying attention.
Exactly. And they're not following their own rules. There's a law called the National Environmental Policy Act that actually guides federal organizations and agencies to look at these impacts before they take action. And so they are beheld to the law to do that, and they haven't been doing that in the past. And so that's our issue, is we want them to take a real deep dive and take a look at the impacts that these feed grounds are having on the environment.
And they, of course, are running on the way things are, because the way they are feeding the elk has been the way they've been feeding the elk for decades. How long?
Exactly. Almost 100, well, over 100 years at this point, the feed grounds have been in operation. So, yeah, it's kind of been status quo for quite some time. And even though we've had information, scientific information that tells us this is not good, it's very much culturally ingrained here. And so, you know, as you know, wildlife issues are not wildlife issues. Wildlife issues are people issues. And this is a perfect example of a cultural norm that needs to be changed. But that's very difficult because some people have values that are closely related to feeding the elk.
Mm-hmm. And from what we understand, there is significant scientific evidence or observations as to what is actually happening to the elk by virtue of being crowded together so closely in these cattle or these elk winter feeding operations, some mm-hmm. of which I understand the density reached in the Jackson area grounds, 1,000 elk per 1 kilometer, square kilometer. That's a lot of elk. And then when you feed them, they even get much closer together, the shoulder to shoulder.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And they're sharing, you know, saliva, and they're eating around each other's, you know, droppings and things like that. So, yeah, they're very packed in very tightly.
So what do the biologists say is happening in that situation?
Yeah, so, you know, really, if you look at the pandemic right now, it gives us a great example of, you know, why are we social distancing? Why are we making sure that we're wearing face coverings? It's the same thing with the elk. We know that density, the higher the density of a biological organism packed in together, is going to, you know, increase transmission rates and then therefore increase prevalence rates of a disease. And so when we have diseases like brucellosis and chronic wasting disease and necrotic stomatitis and some of these other diseases that are on the feed grounds that are now endemic to those areas, we know that those are going to be spread much, much more quickly, and that animals are going to become sick in a much higher rate due to the fact that, you know, they're crowded in so closely. And there is a plethora of scientific evidence that shows us that. And we can look at, for example, like commercial game farms and what happens there. You know, that's another situation where animals are very tightly packed in together on small pieces of land. And we see prevalence rates of diseases go through the roof in places like that. And those people work very hard to keep diseases out of their operations, you know, because they know the consequences are pretty dire. So, yeah, there is no scientist out there that is saying that feeding wildlife is a good thing. We kind of, every scientific evidence piece points to the fact that feeding is not good for wildlife and it helps to spread disease further.
And so how do we come to grips with this then? There have been some wildlife advocates who suggest the possibility of a catastrophe.
Yeah, you know, Everything up to this point has been, the diseases that have been prevalent on the feed grounds have been dire, and you know they're bad for each individual animal that gets that disease. But we've never seen a situation like we have right now with chronic wasting disease, where it is a 100% fatal disease. We know that it's spread amongst animals that are in high densities, and that now we have a situation that is similar to what happens in captive feeding facilities. And we've seen chronic wasting disease rates go up to 90% in captive breeding facilities. And so if now we have a situation that's similar to that in the feed grounds, and chronic wasting disease is now going to be on those feed grounds, there's every reason to think that we could see a pretty significant population impact to elk in northwest Wyoming because of chronic wasting disease.
And if such did happen, it would not be just be, it would not just affect the elk population, but it would affect the population of Wyoming, a significant industry in Wyoming. And not only Wyoming, but it would significantly impact neighboring states like Montana and Idaho, because once the encephalopathy gets around, it goes around, just like COVID. Folks, this is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What. Today we're talking about whether we should or should not weather feed the hungry elk. And by virtue of that, how do we manage our wild life? This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson with Kristen Combs, who is the executive director of the Wyoming Wildlife Advocates in Jackson Hole. Right back.
You can earn a substantial income by farming for the city. All you need to do is take your crop to market and win the competition for the consumer dollars. There is a well-proven strategy for winning this competition. You will find it embedded in MetroFarm, the guide to growing in or near the city for the city.
Polyface Farms, Joel Salatin.
Few how-to books could be more appropriate for our times than MetroFarm, a truly comprehensive manual. MetroFarm makes the whole embedded food system doable. It's a must-read.
USDA Director Bud Kerr.
Big book. MetroFarm describes the agronomic, economic, and managerial concepts required to generate substantial profits from agricultural locales near metropolitan areas.
Before you plant your seeds, pick up a copy of the Ben Franklin Book of the Year award-winning Metro Farm. Then plant your seeds and win the dollars. MetroFarm.com. MetroFarm.com.
So much to say, so little time to say it, on the Food Chain with Michael Olson.
Well, if you've ever seen a herd of elk on a hillside with the sunlight on them, you just marvel at how majestic those ungulates are. It's just spectacular animal, and endemic, especially to the Intermountain West, especially Montana, Wyoming, Idaho, perhaps Utah, even down in New Mexico, and even out here in California, they have reserves of elk, but the one, you know, the Tule elk here in California are really highly managed, and the population is managed. So how do we manage the population of elk? Kristen?
Yeah, that's a complex question too. And a lot goes into that. A lot of science usually goes into that, trying to find out, how many elk do we want, or how many elk do we think is appropriate. And that's something that, humans tend to place on wildlife. We kind of determine what's an acceptable level and what's not, and what the carrying capacity of the land is. And a lot of times, we're keeping surpluses for hunting reasons. That's okay. We just need to, there's a deeper conversation, I think, to be had about what healthy management looks like and managing on ecosystem levels rather than species levels.
And a tough one to do when there are so many economic interests at. Are there any economic interests? I can see one. Economic interests for not feeding the elk. How would you define that? I could see a big one myself.
Certainly. The elk here in Jackson do bring visitors from all around the world to come and see these amazing creatures. And we do have one of the largest elk herds in the country here in Jackson. It drives our tourism industry. People also come here to see bears and wolves, but they love to see elk as well. And so there are, for instance, wildlife guiding tours that will take people out to see elk and other wildlife. And so those industries are really dependent upon having healthy, robust populations of elk herds.
So if there are diseases already being spread amidst the elk populations on the winter feeding grounds of the 22 feeding grounds that are being managed by government agencies throughout Wyoming. So there's already brucellosis, probably other diseases as well, correct?
Yeah, there are. There's a whole host of diseases, really. There's a bacterial disease called hoof rot that is spread pretty readily amongst the animals. As they paw down through the crust of the snow, it tends to cause little nicks and abrasions on their right where the hoof meets the flesh, and that bacteria gets into that area, and then they usually get pretty misshapen hooves as a result of it. They kind of grow too long, and animals then have a hard time getting around, and usually either succumb to being prey
and
to
predators. If they're pawing around a winter feeding ground where there's got to be a lot of microbial activity, that would probably exacerbate the disease spread, would it not?
Yeah, it's something that we don't really see in wild free-ranging populations of elk. We don't see that high prevalence rates of a disease like hoof rot, or there's another one called necrotic stomatitis, which tends to infect the gums and mucous membranes of elk. And so diseases like that we just don't see in wild free-ranging elk herds.
So there it is. And now we have chronic wasting disease. We knew it as mad cow disease, and it sent the whole world into a tiz. Chronic wasting disease, it's an encephalopathy disease that essentially eats holes in the brain.
And so, right. It's caused, the scary thing about chronic wasting disease is that it's not caused by a bacteria or virus, and it's not a living thing. It's a protein. And it's a misfolded protein called a prion that causes this disease. And so the body doesn't recognize it as a foreign substance. And what it does is it goes into an organism, and then other proteins in that organism become like the misshapen protein. And so it replicates itself, and it tends to set up camp in the brain and spinal tissue of different cervid animals. So we're talking elk, deer, moose, and caribou. And then what happens is, it just eats holes in the brain of that animal, and the animal usually becomes pretty listless, lethargic, and can no longer feed itself. And then, then death eventually occurs. But the disease doesn't show symptoms for quite some time. It kind of incubates for a while. And the animal can look perfectly healthy but be infected on the inside, and we just can't see it.
It's kind of like Alzheimer's.
It's very much like Alzheimer's or ALS. It's along the same line of those kind of diseases.
What happens with respect to hunting the cervid population when there's a disease like chronic wasting disease in the brain of the animal that is being hunted?
Yeah, so we're just now starting to sort of see those effects. There are certainly still people that eat meat from animals that have chronic wasting disease. Obviously, the State Department the Wyoming Game and Fish Department, encourages hunters to have their animals tested. There's usually the prion can be found in the lymph node of animals, and so you can send that away after you've hunted an elk. And they're trying to, get the word out about testing. However, there are definitely still people that don't think it's an issue and are still consuming meat from elk that have tested positive or that are positive for chronic wasting disease. And currently, there's no evidence to show that it will cross over to humans. There was a study that was done in Canada where some macaque monkeys were fed meat that was infected with chronic wasting disease, and they did contract the disease. But it was only one study, and it hasn't been replicated since. However, if you look at, you know, something like mad cow, like you mentioned, that was also a situation where we didn't think that would be able to be transmitted to humans. And lo and behold, it eventually was. So it does set up a bit of a human health risk here as well.
How does this situation with respect to winter feeding of elk, what impact does that have on the neighborhood? What are the folks up in Montana and Idaho, who also have significant elk herds, what are they saying to the folks in Wyoming?
Yeah. Well, Montana, they have issued a letter, actually. They sent a letter a few years ago to the Game and Fish Commission here asking them to rethink these feed grounds, because Montana is really feeling the strain from chronic wasting disease, because they have it coming from Canada and then up from Wyoming as well. So they kind of have it, they're getting squished between two endemic areas, and now they have chronic wasting disease that is endemic to their area. And so they see the writing on the wall that the chronic wasting disease could really be facilitated and exacerbated by these feed grounds. And they've pled with the state of Wyoming to stop the feeding. Idaho, on the other hand, does not have chronic wasting disease. It has not been found there yet. The disease has made a steady march across the state of Wyoming and across Montana toward Idaho. Mm-hmm. And so the state is doing everything. The state of Idaho is doing as much as they can to keep chronic wasting disease out of the state. For instance, you can't take, you know, hunted elk, especially the spinal tissue and brain matter across state lines into Idaho. And you have to have your animal tested before you bring it in. And so, they're definitely concerned.
How far away is Jackson from Rexburg, Idaho?
Oh, you know, maybe about 80 miles, 90 miles. We're close. And there are a couple. There's a captive facility of elk just in Victor, Idaho, which is just over Teton Pass, less than 30 miles away. So it's very close. And in fact, there was a moose found about a decade ago in right on the border of Wyoming and Idaho that was tested positive for chronic wasting disease. So it's a real threat. And I'm actually surprised that the state of Idaho is not more concerned and hasn't been more of outspoken about having these feed grounds in Wyoming.
And, you know, in thinking about the situation with respect to a wildlife advocate such as yourself, a person who truly loves wildlife, what do your friends tell you? What do your friends say when you tell them that you're working on a campaign to stop the government from feeding animals?
You know, there's definitely folks that are still in the mindset of like, oh, we have to take care of animals and we need to feed them in the winter. And but I think most of my sort of inner circle of people understands the risk and threat to feeding wildlife and understands that we need to have a healthy, balanced ecosystem. And that doesn't involve feeding wildlife. And so, but there certainly are still many, many citizens here that do feed wildlife and also, you know, are very heartfelt toward animals. And I mean, I have the utmost compassion for our wild neighbors, which is one of the reasons that I care so much about this issue, is because I know how harmful this could be to them. And not only is it an awful situation on a population level, but it's also an awful situation on individual levels for each elk. This is a horrible way for them to die.
May I ask you a personal question?
Sure.
Have you ever hunted elk?
I have not hunted elk. No, I am not a hunter. I've certainly eaten elk meat, and we have friends who hunt and sometimes offer us elk meat. I'm mostly vegetarian, although I do eat some meat every now and then. And so, you know, I 100% respect people that want to go out and fill their freezer each year with healthy elk and deer meat. It's much better than buying food from a factory farm. It's much healthier. It's very lean meat. You know, it's a wonderful tradition to keep going, but
and it also helps manage the herd.
Exactly, yes. So, you know, there's nothing bad about hunting elk and deer at all. And I encourage people that want to keep that tradition alive. However, when I see, it confuses me when I see hunters who are really defensive of the feed grounds, just because scientifically we know it's bad to feed wildlife. And I mean, even the Wyoming Game and Fish Department themselves discourages people from feeding wildlife and oftentimes puts out, you know, bulletins telling people don't feed wildlife in your backyard. But then somehow they think that them, you know, they're allowed to feed wildlife, which is just kind of a hypocrisy of the deepest level. And so, you know, it's confusing to me. And I think maybe part of it is just long-term versus short-term. You know, I think some people have a hard time seeing into the future and really seeing what the impact of this disease could look like down the road.
Which could be catastrophic.
Definitely could be something very, very serious and could affect everything in the ecosystem, all the way from the elk populations down to, you know, our native carnivores as well, not having enough food. So, yeah, there's big consequences, I think, here at stake.
Well, okay, Kristen Combs, Executive Director of the Wyoming Wildlife Advocates. By virtue of my literary license, I'm going to put you in charge of fixing the situation. What do we do?
I wish I had a magic wand. You know, the thing is that we know what needs to be done. Now, knowing that,
What needs to be done?
We need to phase out the feed grounds. You know, stopping them cold turkey, probably not the best idea because we would have some elk that starve. But through a situation of increased hunting tags, letting wolves do their natural job of helping to call the herds and call the sick and weak, and slowly backing off the feeding over the next few years.
I hear the hunters yelling, you know, you can't reduce the supply of our business.
Exactly. So that is where the pinch point is. And it was so biologically and scientifically, we know what we need to do. However, socially and culturally, that's where the complications come in.
Ah, so there's the task. Then how do you convince? You know, it seems to me, I once did a show way back when they were reintroducing wolves into the Yellowstone ecosystem, and I was sitting at doing a live show at the kitchen table of a sheep rancher outside of Big Timber, Montana, and I was asking him what he thought of the wolves that are now eating a sheep. And he was kind of dumbfounded as to how to answer the question. And just at that very moment, the fish and game person responsible for reintroducing the wolves walked into his kitchen, and he had an antenna on his, holding an antenna in his hand. And he said, "She's back," as if she's back. And so I had the opportunity to ask him live on television why they were reintroducing wolves. And I said, "Is it to control the population of cervids?" And he said, "No, it's to please city people." And if you ever have the opportunity to drive through Yellowstone Park these days in the winter or whatever, they're lined up forever along the Lamar Valley looking for wolves. So I guess you're going to have to convince city people.
This is true. It's always a cultural, I feel like wildlife issues always come down to human values and cultural norms and cultural traditions.
And there we are. With that, we have to kind of call it a day, but I want to thank you, Kristen Combs, Executive Director of Wyoming Wildlife Advocates, and wish for you the best of the new year, and I hope you find a new way to manage elk. And thank you all out there for tuning in the Food Chain Radio program.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Radio Show with Michael Olson. And if your friends missed the show, tell them to log on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com for a listen. now go out and find some food with its farmer's face on it and live.